third part of the interview with Harold Saunders by William Burr took place in Washington, D.C. on April 8, 1987.
Continue with the Carter period. I read that William Butler, of the International Commission of Jurists, met from time to time with the Shah to discuss human rights issues in Iran. When you were at the INR or later on at the Near Eastern Affairs Division, did you know whether he coordinated his activities with the State Department, and if he did, how closely he worked with the State?
The precise answer is I don't know directly. My sense is that the word coordinates probably too, a little too formal. Was he in touch with the department? I think he was. My evidence for that is not anything that happened in 1979, but, or excuse me, 1977 when Carter first came in, but later on during the hostage crisis, I remember we thought about him in that context a fair amount, and some of my colleagues in the Bureau seemed to know him, seemed to know him reasonably well. So I suspect they were in contact. What that contact amounted to, I don't know. I can't believe that he wasn't in contact with the Human Rights Bureau as well as the Near Eastern Bureau.
I was wondering if you ever got any sense that his efforts might have been sort of a partial substitute for direct diplomatic pressure by the U.S. But maybe
I doubt the coordination would have been that strong. This is an international, I mean, an organization which had its own independence, and it may have acted in ways that were, in fact, complementary to the administration's policy, but I don't think they would have been seen as substituting.
Okay. Now, in early 1978, when you were still at the INR division, anti-Shah demonstrations in Iran occurred on a nationwide basis. After police opened fire on student protesters at Qom Religious Center. Do you remember if those events generated much discussion at your division?
Yes, they certainly did. They were we paid attention to them right from the start, and then of course we went into the 40-day cycle of the demonstrations after the initial ones. I may have my timing off by a few weeks, but I think it was probably in March that we called in the first in a series of, we called in four, the first of a series of meetings, a group of about a half a dozen American Iran specialists from the academic world to talk about what was indeed going on in Iran. That group came back certainly one, maybe two more times in 1978, not necessarily in exactly the same membership, but with about the same composition, with a few coming and going. And then after the hostages were taken, we had them in several times. I can't remember how many now, to talk about obviously a different subject, which was to help us understand the mentality of a Khomeini and the group around him, Shia Islam, and so on. So INR started right away to write about and analyze these questions. I think it's fair to say that as of that point in March, when we had the scholars come in, I think it's fair to say that nobody, the scholars or the government analysts, anticipated the rapidity with which the process of accumulating resistance to the Shah would materialize. People knew something was qualitatively different about what was going on, but the thought that it would snowball the way it eventually did and that the Shah would be gone by the end of the year, I don't think anybody was saying in March. Some of the scholars may today have covered their rear ends by saying something, citing something they wrote back then, but that's neither here nor there. The point is that we were watching it, we knew something different was going on, but and certainly as late as late June, early July, our ambassador, when he was back on the summer leave, was asked the question, the analytical question about what this was doing to the regime, and the answer at that time from him was that the Shah was having difficulty, but the Shah would prevail. Now it's interesting to look behind that, and that was the ambassador's message to Washington in the early summer of 1978. I obviously talked to a lot of the people who were serving in Iran, both in the embassy and in the consulate. And there were people in the consulate at that time who said later on, and I think quite honestly, that they were operating from the assumption by this time in the second quarter of 1978 that the Shah was done for. One of them told me one time he was shocked to come back to Washington at some point and find that the State Department was working from the assumption that the ambassador articulated, namely that the Shah was in difficulty, but the Shah would prevail. So you have a case here of people operating from different assumptions, but the person who reported from the assumption that the Shah was done for acknowledges that he never articulated the working assumption. He reported what was going on, but he never, for some reasons, either because the ambassador had a different view or didn't occur to him to say, my basic premises have changed. He was reporting what was going on, and wherever it was, Isfahan or Tabriz or wherever. So there was a lot of analytical turmoil in the first half of the year, but one thing it illustrates is the difficulty for any analyst of current affairs, be he or she academic or government, in putting a finger on a particular moment and saying things have changed and will never again be the same. Something different is happening here, and we have to shift all of our premises. We have passed a point of no return of some kind. It's one of the toughest analytical questions. It's easier for the historian to do than the person living through the event. And of course, the senior policymaker, like the president, has a double problem. He has the fundamental analytical problem, just deciding when things have changed. But then, for a president to begin operating on a new set of premises, or for a president to be known to be operating on a new set of premises, becomes in itself a factor in the situation. Picture the word going around Tehran that Jimmy Carter had written off the Shah, and that would be a political force or factor in Tehran. So, well, anyway, against the background of the analysis, the analytical activity in the first half of the year, if one moves to the second half of the year, I think one could note on a calendar July to 78 through January 79. Just note when individuals reached the conclusion that we had passed the point of no return and that the Shah was really done for within some foreseeable period of time. Some people who were early on the calendar include the Director of Iranian Affairs in the State Department, Henry Precht. Some people who might be quite late on the calendar would be somebody like Zbigniew Brzezinski, and of course the formal position of the embassy changed explicitly on whatever that date was, November 4th or whatever, when Bill Sullivan sent his telegram entitled "Thinking the Unthinkable."
Yeah, so, copy right here.
So what was the date? It's November.
November 8th, I think.
8th. Okay. Anyway. Just take that spread out there, and you can spot other individuals on the calendar. And I don't do that at all to criticize anybody. It's just the fact that It was the second half of 78, not the first half of 78, when people began to realize that the that we were looking to a future without the Shah.
Mm-hmm. Going over some of the things you mentioned in the last 10 minutes or so, when these events started breaking out, the 40-day cycle early in 78, how did people interpret them? What did they think was going on? Just like a major crisis that could be resolved in time? Or,
well, as I said, yeah. I think when the cycle began to repeat, and that mm-hmm. didn't take very long, but mm-hmm. I think people looked at those demonstrations, not just the recurrent nature of them, but the quality of the demonstrations themselves very early, mm-hmm. and said, this has a different smell to it from mm-hmm. things that have happened before. More different kinds of people seem to be involved. It seems to be broader than the dissatisfactions of one group in one town. Mm-hmm. It seems to have some resonance that reaches more widely, and therefore it doesn't look like anything that we might have seen recently. It has broader significance. I think that was implicit in the analysis right from the start. Now, as I say, people did not automatically just plotted how people moved to the conclusion that the Shah was done for. They did not do that, and by and large, I think, in the first half of 78.
Who were some of the academic experts that came in? Was James Bill one of them?
Jim Bill was one of them. I can't remember all their names, but Marvin Zonas was a second in Chicago, mm-hmm. and I'm drawing a blank at the moment, but he's at Brown University. I don't remember the other three offhand.
Okay, changing the subject slightly. In February, I guess, of 78, you were nominated Assistant Secretary of State for Interior State Affairs, I think.
I guess it was. I can't remember when I was nominated. I was sworn in on April 11th. I guess it would have been sometime in February.
So you started working in the office in April, basically.
Yeah, I was sworn in on April 11th and started working in April 12th.
Uh-huh. Uh-huh. What circumstances led to this? To your appointment there at that division.
Oh, it was a sort of natural evolution in the later Kissinger, from 74 or 75, I was Deputy Assistant Secretary in the Near Eastern Bureau. At that time, with a focus on the Arab-Israeli peace process, I was flying on the Kissinger shuttles, participated in all the shuttles and the mediation of the three Arab-Israeli agreements in 74 and 75. As 76 approached, it looked as if it was going to be a relatively quiet year, election year. New negotiations in the Middle East were going to await post-election period. Bill Hyland was moved from being Director of Intelligence and Research back to be Deputy to Brent Scowcroft as NSC advisor, and Kissinger appointed me to INR. Then came the transition from Kissinger to Vance. Bill Habib was the Undersecretary for Political Affairs and remained so under Vance. His idea, which Vance agreed with, was that Atherton wouldn't stay in the Near Eastern Bureau forever, that I had the continuity of involvement in the peace process, mm-hmm. and therefore I should stay in INR, because Atherton was being kept on as Assistant Secretary for Near East, but as the logical successor, mm-hmm. and that is indeed what happened. And the reason, actually during that period when I was Director of Intelligence and Research, I traveled to the Middle East on each of Vance's trips. I participated in all the policy making in the Middle East, so I kept my involvement while having this other set of responsibilities. As in early 78, of course, was the period after Sadat's visit to Jerusalem, it became apparent that we needed somebody to pay full-time attention to taking that initiative and turning it into another round of negotiation. So Roy Atherton was the logical person to be moved out of the Assistant Secretary's job to become Ambassador at Large, which he did, and I moved in behind him. So the occasion for it was really nothing more than the formal beefing up of the Arab-Israeli mechanisms to deal with something that the President had given very high priority to, dealing with the Israeli-Palestinian-Jordanian-Egyptian problems. Of course, we went on then very relatively quickly after that to Camp David, the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty.
Okay. Now, when you were Secretary of State, in the early months of your tenure there, how much time, maybe say spring of 78 through the fall or so, how much, this is quite hard to answer, but how much time did you put into Iran compared to, say, the Near East peace settlement issues?
Well, remember, we also had in the same bureau the change of government in Afghanistan, just for another major turnaround. Well, if you look at the priority time went into the Arab-Israeli mm-hmm. peace process, mm-hmm. and the other thing is that the Iranian problem was still seemed like an analytical problem that summer, so we paid attention to it, and I think the question we should have paid more attention to it, I'm not sure what we would have done differently, but we should have paid more attention to it. Kerry Sick's book outlines very well when the first formal meetings were held, and obviously that was much later than it should have been. The problem, I think, your question really becomes doubly cogent after early September, July, August. We were talking a lot about it among ourselves. All the analysis was being done. People like Henry Precht were beginning to say that this is really very different, and we talked about what we should do about it. But of course, everything got notched up another run on the ladder. Actually, while we were at Camp David, because the Jolly Square riot and shootings took place while we were at Camp David, Carter called the Shah from Camp David and so on. But we were at Camp David, and in the period thereafter, we were engaged in the negotiation of the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty. During that period, the person who really paid much more full-time attention for persons paid much more full-time attention to it were my principal deputy, Bill Crawford, and Henry Precht, who was the director of Iranian affairs. And I can remember coming back from Camp David and having discussions with them about the need to look more sharply at this and at options and so on. And I think the bureaucratic mechanism within the bureau, anyway, again cranked up to a new level of activity in that period. Although in October 78, I was sent to the Middle East to explain Camp David to the Saudis and to King Hussein. I visited Israel and the West Bank. So and so, there's no, and Vance, of course, was heavily engaged in that whole negotiation, as well as continuing work on SALT. And I think he made a trip, well, I know he made a trip to Southern Africa in October when I was in the Middle East with Hussein. So, there were a lot of things going on that fall, and it certainly is a fair point for analysis to look at that old question of how many major issues can a president or secretary of state cope with on the agenda at a given time.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, you mentioned Henry Precht and William Crawford. Were they the main people that you listened to when it came to Iranian matters?
Yeah. Bill Crawford was my principal deputy, but also he had, every deputy had certain parts of the bureau which he oversaw. So in addition to being my principal deputy, Crawford happened to be responsible for that part of the bureau that dealt with the Arabian Peninsula and Iran, in other words, the Persian Gulf, both sides. So for two reasons, one, because he was acting in my absence, and two, because that was his area of concern anyway. Mm-hmm. He would have focused on that.
Okay. Now, during this period, before September 78, did you discuss Iranian internal social developments, political developments with either Secretary Vance or Secretary Christopher?
I'm sure we did, but I can't give you a particular date. I don't remember meetings, particular meetings and so on, but certainly right from the start, when I was still in the Intelligence Bureau, it was part of the daily memo that we sent up at appropriate points, and I'm sure there are Sure, we would normally have done a memo after the meeting with Ms. Collars, and it was the subject of almost continuous reporting.
Did you get a sense of what level of concern that they had about the issues before the fall?
I think it's about the same as everybody else. There's something different going on here. And then, of course, everybody had questions for Ambassador Sullivan when he came back on home leave that summer. And again, I just remember his statement, yes, something different's going on. The Shah is in trouble, but the Shah, he'll make it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the way the world operates when a Secretary of State hears his ambassador to Iran say, well, it's going to be rough, but you don't have to have meetings about the impending fall of the Shah right now. I think that contributed a great deal to, if he'd had a different message. I'm not saying this to blame Bill Sullivan, because he faced the same problem everybody did, that is, when do you begin to call it differently? And of course, he suffered from that problem that I spoke about, the president suffered from. If an ambassador changes his assessment, says the Shah is done for, that's going to get around too, and that's going to be a factor in Tehran. So.
Mm-hmm. Now, during August 1978, in a declassified memo which I've seen, there had been a new wave of anti-Shah demonstrations, and you wrote a memo to Secretary Vance saying that the U.S. should, and this is a quote, concentrate our influence on persuading the Shah to hold to liberalization, which you saw as the only sensible course for long-term stability. Now, by this point, how did you define liberalization?
Broadening the participation in the in the government, trying to take the main centers of opposition and represent them somehow in the government. The Shah did broaden his government in September, but it was moved to the military, not in the way that we had. I think there's a fairly consistent strain of thinking in the Near Eastern Bureau along these lines, that actually you see articulated in the George Ball report much later in the fall. Ball, I don't know, you can ask him, he talked to a lot of people, I'm sure, but I remember going to his suite in the hotel on a Sunday night to have dinner with him, Henry Precht and I guess. Maybe it was just the three of us, maybe it was the fourth, I can't remember. But anyway, we spent 3 or 4 hours with him. This was later in the fall. That by that time, this idea of broadening the base had taken the form of a council of notables or something like that. In other words, it was notched, elevated again one step beyond the idea of just broadening the base, because the Shah hadn't done it that way. But that was the persistent way of approaching the problem in NEA from sometime in the summer on, and that you pinpointed at least as early as August, it may have been earlier.
Did you see liberalization in any way as including for major structural changes in the regime, like maybe some diminution of the Shah's authority? Or
in the longer term, I don't think we saw that as happening in the middle of a crisis. First step would be the practicalities of defusing the crisis by bringing responsible people in from the bazaar, from the various groups that were in the streets. Later on, at some point, yes, but when things had calmed down and people could be more deliberative in their approach.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Incidentally, I mean, that stream of thinking came out in other ways too, and sending somebody to see Khomeini in Paris and seeing whether you could get the military in January, the Heiser mission. The thought behind that was, I mean, one person's thought behind it was to marshal the military to save the Shah. Another school of thought was the military may very well be the biggest single element of continuity if the Shah leaves and Khomeini comes, and rather than it'd be better off to have the military figuring out how to do business with the new leaders of Iran and preserve some coherence to a regime than to be out in the streets simply defending the Shah. that line of thought, I think, was consistent in the department throughout. Now, it took different forms at different times, and it's another question of how we handle that that idea bureaucratically. But I think Cy Vance was very much of this mind, although I don't want to put words in his mouth.
Okay. Now, in early September 78, the embassy's political officer, John Semple, met with a special assistant to the prime minister of Iran and told him that the U.S. would support the reestablishment of order by force as long as liberalization continued under the Shah's direction. Now, shortly thereafter, the government declared martial law, and you had the Black Friday, what we call the Black Friday events. Now, I have a copy of the memo which I saw, and Semple's signal appeared to have some sort of significance, I would think. But could he have made the statement he did without authority from Washington?
No, again, I can't cite specific dates and telegrams of instruction, but when you're getting to this point, you're getting to the moment where I think Bill Sullivan's criticism of Washington is probably fair. That is, that he was getting two signals from Washington. There were two points of view. There was the Brzezinski point of view, which was to use the military to crack down, preserve order, and so on, and then you could move on to other things. Well, the way this got brokered up in this period, the way a number of instructions got brokered out was precisely in the kind of way that you just described, embassy being instructed to tell, recommend that the Shah be firm, but at the same time to recognize that the fundamental solution was a long-term broadening of the government and so on. Preserve order for the sake of broadening the government. So I think the other side of it is I seem to remember but probably in August or September, maybe it was right at this time that you're mentioning, Bill Sullivan having a conversation with the Shah, in which the Shah said, "I'm not going to rule Iran in a pool of blood," or almost in those words. I think it was at this time, too, that you began getting a lot of thought in Washington about the state of the Shah's psyche. That is, I remember thinking to myself at one point, and I don't have the vaguest notion whether this was hindsight of a couple of years or whether I was thinking it at the time now, but at some point the thought occurred to me that the biggest single missing ingredient in the picture in Iran was the Shah himself. We became aware about this time that the Shah seemed absent in the psychological sense of the word. And I think we had, there were a couple of high-level visitors that went there. I think the Treasury, our Treasury Secretary visited Iran somewhere right in this period. And the burning question at the American end of these high-level meetings with the Shah was, what was your impression of the Shah? Does he seem passive and so on? And the reports generally were that he seemed passive and so on. And if you think back to earlier periods when he had trouble, the 60s and so on, out of the trouble in the 60s came the White Revolution. He jumped out in front of the opposition, almost in the end co-opted it or gave it a way to channel its energies and won it over, at least for a period of time. And I think we kept looking in this formulation of broadening the government, kept looking for, this time, not a white revolution in the social economic sense, but a political addendum to the white revolution where you would broaden the participation in politics. You remember, I think I said in one of our earlier interviews that the Shah said as early as 69-70, if I don't solve this problem of institutionalizing political participation, my son will never rule in Iran. Well, a lot of us remembered that, and not that particular thing, but it had been a stream in our thinking all through the 70s, and I think came out here again with the thought that if the Shah really wanted to deal with the opposition, he needed to leapfrog it, get out in front take some sort of dramatic step to capture people in some new political reform and so on. And that was the, I guess, the model that was in our minds. But the problem with, one problem with it among many, I suppose, was that the Shah just did not seem ready, able to exert that kind of creative, imaginative leadership or to project a sense of leadership to the Iranian people. Now, what was going on in his mind? Was it just a natural reaction to the, what he saw going on, not being, that sense of not knowing quite what to do about it? Or did he really have a renewed sense of his own illness? Of course, we didn't know that until 13 months later, so. But if he was struggling with that, a man knowing he was potentially terminally ill, coping with all this going on out in the streets, might just as well have psychologically given up.
Have there been any rumors at all about possible illness? You know, not any speculation that you can remember?
No, I think you can, if you went back through everything, all the CIA material and so on, you would find it true that the first inkling, now you can say this shows the dereliction of the intelligence capacity or whatever you want, but the first real inkling we had of anything like that was that message in the fall of 79, mm-hmm. which led to the admission of the Shah to the United States for treatment.
Right. Okay. And also in September of 78, Gary Sick of the NSC staff proposed to you, so he says in his book, he proposed to you that the State Department hold informal talks with one of Khomeini's representatives, Ibrahim Yazdi.
Yeah.
I guess Sick had the connection with Yazdi through Richard Cottom. Do you recall what you thought of Cottom's suggestions at that time?
Cottom was one of the members of, I don't know how I ever drew a blank on his name, but he fairly early became a member of that academic group that I should have remembered his name before. We respected Cottom highly, knew certainly of his numerous connections, and were always interested in taking advantage of the knowledge that people had of that kind. We did, of course. A little bit later than the month that you're mentioning, probably late November, early December, we did crank up the a mission for Ted Elliott to go and see Yazdi in Paris. Since when we couldn't do that, we authorized Warren Zimmerman and the embassy in Paris to go and talk with him and so on. So.
Well, this is one in September, September 78, though, proposed.
Yeah, but you see, even at the point when we did it, it was turned off, mm-hmm. not in the State Department, but in Gary's own shop. Mm-hmm. It wasn't us that rejected these ideas, it was his bosses.
In terms of the September proposal, you were supportive of that?
I can't remember a particular proposal at that time. I know that given our inclination to be in touch with people and to try to broker some kind of broadening of the base, it would have seemed natural to me to include an approach like that as part of your effort. You remember, I came at this moment from 4 years of involvement in the Arab-Israeli peace process, where we went and sat in the middle of the problem and talked to virtually everybody, and that there were some people like the PLO we didn't want to talk to right then. We had a lot of ways of including them in the dialogue indirectly. So our whole approach as a bureau, and I think as an administration, was to think in terms of political process. How do you put people together to get to move from a bad situation to a better one? And the idea of liberalization, that's not an American political word. That just happens to be a short hand way of talking about a political process that would have turned the opposition more constructively into support of a political process by which the Shah could have been retained perhaps as a constitutional monarch down the road. All of these things were just the mentality with which the department was looking at the problem. And everybody dealing with this was either intimately, as I was, or certainly lived with people who were intimately involved in that process, most of all the Secretary of State.
Yes. Now, when did you yourself personally conclude that the Shah's days were over? In terms of the calendar you mentioned,
Gary Sick is very good about on this point. Gary says that he thinks it's fair to answer that question as it refers to oneself only by citing the moment when you put your judgment in writing. Gary had the opportunity in going back over files before he left the government and before he wrote this book to do that for himself. I haven't done that for myself, and I don't know what a fair question is. If I answer you off the top of my head, I would think that probably sometime in early September, when I came back from Camp David after Jolly Square and so on, I really found a different atmosphere, an even more concerned atmosphere in the Bureau. Crawford saying to me that we just had to pay more attention to this problem and it was getting worse and so on and so forth. And I think, we had the memo you cited there was the earlier one is August, so it isn't that we weren't thinking. But I think I probably belong somewhere in the September group.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Now, also according to Sixth Book, which I relied upon pretty heavily, this is so.
It's a very good book. Yeah, Gary's done a very fine job. I respect him and his work a great deal.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Well, he says, maybe this is quite hard to remember specific papers that you might have approved at some point, but he says that by late October, some State Department officials, probably a number of them, feared a military takeover in Iran and concluded that the Ambassador Sullivan, should play a stronger role in giving advice to the Shah so that he could build a more effective government. Now, do you recall, I guess you sort of mentioned what kind of advice you would have had the ambassador give in terms of liberalization, but did you talk, was this proposal discussed with Secretary Vance, this idea of having Sullivan take a stronger role in the situation, and was that discussed with Vance at any line?
I don't remember, but again, our picture in a variety of situations and the Lebanon is another one which is going on precisely at this time, where you had a country taking itself apart from the inside. You had a strong ambassador, an ambassador who felt that his job was to keep Lebanon from disrupting the Camp David process. Ambassador Dean operated by making himself a force within Lebanon, trying to keep factions in touch with each other, trying to bring people together who were straying apart, and so on. My mentality at the time was that the most effective way of dealing with a situation where a country is coming apart from the inside, which now by this time applied also to Iran, was to have a strong ambassador with a political sense of how perhaps to construct the political scenario for achieving what you wanted to achieve. Mm-hmm. Certainly in Lebanon, I did not feel that I was smart enough, or probably that we were smart enough in Washington, to instruct the ambassador to do A this way, B that way, go see C and tell him that, and so on. We relied on the ambassador to play a role within certain broad instructions. And I think what the mentality would have been at the time, that if you wanted to construct this political process that we had in mind, we couldn't design it from Washington. You had to design it on the scene, sitting in the middle of the scene, and having a strong ambassador talk to everybody, see what he could put together. Just as in a third in the Arab-Israeli peace process, we didn't sit in Washington and design some solution to the Arab-Israeli conflict. We went out there and had been out there since after the 73 war, now 5 years before that, sitting in the middle of the problem, working with people, talking about partial solutions and so on. We made ourselves part of the political process. That was my concept of the way an ambassador would function. I didn't know exactly what he should do, whom he should suggest to the Shah be brought into the government. That was his job. So that's the prevailing concept. I again can't remember whether I wrote it to Vance in those words or what. That's the record would show.
By this point, when you're making a suggestion like that to Vance, was he responsive to those kinds of suggestions?
No, he was. I think we were pretty much of the same mind. By we, I include my colleagues in the Bureau as well as the Secretary. You asked earlier whether I spoke to Warren Christopher about this. There was, the way the Division of Labor worked out on the seventh floor was that there were just some issues Vance dealt with and some issues Christopher dealt with, and it just happened that Arab-Israeli peace process, Lebanon, now Iran, Afghanistan, the big issues that were going to have to be dealt with the President, with the Congress, with the press and so on, were issues that naturally gravitated the Secretary. So most of my work was with the Secretary.
I got the sense from looking at Vance's memoirs that he refers to Craig's views that the Shah was on his way out, basically, that new people had to be brought into power somehow. But he suggests that he differed from Craig, even during the fall, in terms of he disagreed with Craig's analysis, that he believed the Shah still had to be supported in some way.
Well, Precht is making two points, that analytically something was qualitatively different, and it looked as if the Shah could not survive. In any case, whether that was true or not, well, all that said to us was, we better think differently about what we do in Iran. The point that followed from that was that if the Shah had any chance of survival or of prolonging his tenure or playing a constructive role in a transition, the way you did that was to broaden the base of the Shah's government. So Precht wasn't advocating the overthrow of the Shah.
No.
And therefore, I think Vance may himself, no, I think probably very few people would have said as early as Henry Precht did that the Shah was done for. They weren't ready to make that intellectual jump. I think Vance is saying that when he says he needed to defend the Shah, and so, well, sure, we thought the way to defend for the Shah to defend himself was to engage in the political process that I mentioned.
Okay. Now, I've read then that in late October or so, prominent people like John J. McCoy were urging Secretary Vance and others to use U.S. influence to support a crackdown against dissidents in Iran. Do you recall any pressure from people like McCoy, any phone calls?
I don't remember any to myself. Those calls normally came in to people on the seventh floor, like David Newsom or the Secretary himself.
But you never, Vance never got in touch with you, for example. I mean, McCoy never talked with you during this period.
I don't think so.
Okay. But you never heard anything about such.
I don't know whether I did or not. It was not unusual at all to have all kinds of people getting on the telephone in the middle of a crisis like this. I would have expected it would have been the norm. Didn't register with me, obviously.
Okay. On November 2nd, a special coordinating committee of the NSC began reviewing policy towards Iran. I guess it's the first time that high-level officials had started looking at it in a systematic way. Is that so?
That's what Gary Book says. I'm sure that's okay.
Now, before that point, had you or any of your advisors at the Iran desk been trying to encourage such a process to begin, like a high-level deliberation?
I just can't remember exactly what we would have said to Vance. Obviously, we were writing memos to Vance, and we were also in touch by telephone with Gary Sick, so there was communication. At what point we began talking together about having a meeting of that kind. I just don't remember.
Okay. I'll turn the tape over.
Sure.